From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
Imagine walking into your hotel in Mexico City during a family crisis and finding 100 tamales delivered to your room. Then for the following 3 years, receiving concerned texts, uplifting emails, and bouquets of flowers which could hardly get through the front door. Imagine a friend who makes a lightsaber with your name engraved on it while directing Star Wars with a cast and crew of thousands and designing a Lego digital model of the River Cafe for your birthday, confessing later, more challenging than directing a movie, and what movies they are, brilliant, beautiful movies we wait for and require. A friend who makes you laugh so much through dinners at your restaurant, the staff look on and wonder. This is J.J. Abrams, who I'm here with today to talk about food and family and friendship. Imagine how happy I am to be with someone I love.
I mean, seriously, I can't follow that at all. What are you doing? I got chills four times when you were reading that. I mean, seriously.
It's true.
That's impossible.
No, it's really possible. You know, it's true, every word
well,
of it. So I can't imagine.
And here we are. I adore you and love you and thank you.
Okay, we're done now.
That was it.
That was it.
There's nothing better than that. Seriously, we should quit now.
Well, we can't because we have to find a
no.
recipe. Which one should we do? That? Would you carbonara or chocolate cake?
Let's do carbonara. It's,
yeah, okay,
you kidding
that's
me?
A nice Rome.
Oh my God.
Rome, did you ever work in Rome? Have you ever lived in Rome?
The first day of shooting on Mission 3 was in Rome.
Was it?
Yeah.
Was it? And how long did you stay?
We were there for a few weeks.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
I think it's the most beautiful city in the world.
It's unbelievable. So do you want me to just read it?
Yes. Yep.
All right. And is it Penne Regatta?
Yeah.
Okay. I competed in the Penne Regatta once.
In the Regatta?
Seriously, I'm so stupid. Okay, here we go. All right. Penne alla carbonara. Here we go. For us, the two most important ingredients are excellent free-range eggs and pancetta stessa. This serves six. You start with 200 grams, 7 ounces, of pancetta cut into matchsticks, 1 tablespoon olive oil, 6 egg yolks, 120 milliliters, 4 fluid ounces, of double cream, 150 grams, 5 ounces, Parmesan, freshly grated, 250 grams, 9 ounces, of Penne Regatta. Fry the pancetta and the olive oil slowly so that it releases its own fat before becoming crisp. Add some black pepper. Beat the egg yolks with the cream and season with salt and pepper. Add half the Parmesan. Meanwhile, cook the penne in a generous amount of boiling salted water, then drain thoroughly. Combine immediately with the hot pancetta and the oil, and then pour in the cream mixture. Stir to coat each pasta piece. The heat from the pasta will cook the egg slightly. Finally, add the remaining Parmesan and serve.
Beautiful. So what was food like when you were growing up? So your mother would say, cook, she was a cook? Or did
she was a cook, and she would make, you know, traditional, like, brisket, Jewish sort of food. She would also make, you know, she made an amazing Caesar salad. For some reason, her Caesar salad was fantastic.
Really?
I don't know what it was. It was great. She was always about what we were eating, and to a point where it was insane. Like we'd be sitting at a lunch that she would have made, and the conversation she wanted to have would be about dinner.
The next
meal. And it'd be like, I'm trying, you know, we're just eating. But weirdly, now I do tend to look forward to food in a way that is probably not right-sized, is probably vaguely, it's not like an obsession, but it's like, it's super important.
And is that at home? Do you think at home with your kids, or just now you're thinking about what you're going to eat
in
tonight?
In general, I think food is such a, it's something that, like, I know this is going to sound insane, but I literally get sad when I'm like halfway through a meal.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, wait a minute. Like,
it's going to end?
Yeah, because like, it's going to be over soon. Yeah. And it's a very, and I do think there's probably some strong analogy to life in that. Yeah. That there's something about it that you just feel like, oh no,
it's,
you know, this is, you don't want this to go away. She was always concerned that you weren't eating enough, while you were eating. Also, it's interesting because she, like myself, she always talked about herself and felt that she was fat. And she was incredibly not fat.
Yeah, no, and you're not fat.
But like, whatever the body dysmorphia thing. Yeah, but like, but, and yet, both she and I, like, it's not like we then shy away from food.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. Like, it's like, I love, you know, and as a kid, you know, when I was, you know, young, I definitely was a chubby kid, but I was never, like, athletic. So I sort of probably conflated that feeling of being chubby as a kid and then not a very good athlete with somehow just being a bit of a fat slob. But I loved food. I remember as a kid, I was always, you know, I was always making things.
Did you? Yeah, you cooked as a kid. With her or by yourself?
Both.
Yeah. What would you cook?
Well, whatever she was making. She would, like, be doing, you know, all sorts of things. And it was also, like, L.A. in the 70s, so it was, like, you know, like, stuffed zucchini thing. Yeah. Just things that were just, like, very much of that era. She would cook. But the thing that I was most, beyond her just being, to a fault probably, loving. I mean, she was so loving that it was like, I remember thinking, I know it's not as good as you think it is, whatever it is I've done. But the thing that I really take away the most was that switching up what you do and how you define yourself and who you are is part of living, that not being defined by a label or any one thing. And she was someone who, when we moved to Los Angeles and I was only five, we moved from New York, she's early on started being a real estate agent. And then she, you know, she was interested in art and started doing classes and became a painter. But then she was going to be 40 and she thought, you know, she wanted to be a lawyer and she was asking around, is it crazy to start law school, you know, when you're 30? She asked someone and I remember their response to her was, you know, in 2 years you're going to be 40 either way.
Yeah.
You know, and then she went to law school and graduated top of her class. And then she became a law professor and she was doing that for a while. And then she wanted to go into producing and she did that. You know, she was someone who was constantly creating and but also shape-shifting.
Would you sit down to dinner every night?
Yeah, we would sit.
Whatever you were doing.
We would sit at the table most every night, although obviously at a certain point. And it might not be. Frankly, as I say this, I'm sure that if my sister's listening to this, she's probably like laughing and saying, what are you talking about every night? You know, my guess is it's probably far less frequently than my memory suggests. But I have, you know, I have a real sense of and memory of sitting together with the family. But but it was also, you know, I have to say, because it was that era, and I think being in Los Angeles in the 70s, there was a bit of like carelessness, and I know that I'm comparing it to some of the more kind of helicopter parenty crap that happens today, which is not healthy at all either. But there was a bit of a kind of benign neglect, and maybe not even benign sometimes, that would happen with parents. And I certainly feel like I was safe. I never felt like, oh my God, my parents are like crazy. They were not like druggy, nutty, out of their minds, you know. But there were, in that era, and whether it was like various, you know, cults that were around, whether it was like this kind of, the culture was such a kind of freewheeling, odd sort of place to grow up, that I remember seeing a lot of friends whose parents were kind of off the rails as parents. And, but I will say that, like, I do have a sense that there were times when I think my sister and I were a little bit on our own too, in terms of like not really being supervised the way you'd think kids should be.
But you came out, you know, I look at my kids and I, you know, when you are a grandparent, you'll see that you kind of it's great having grandchildren, but the really interesting thing is to see them as parents, your children as parents. It's very revealing. And I think I often look back and, you know, Richard and myself, and we certainly were not as attentive as they are.
No, but I'm
just really sorry, Zed, but I do think we were, you know.
I do think that you, you know, you're constantly learning lessons. I'm fascinated with what you're talking about because I think there's obviously this sort of seismic shift that happens when what was your primary family shifts into a slightly into a different, you know, to the, not the rear view, but a very different position. And your primary family becomes the family you choose to make. But then there's another shift that happens again when then your kids shift.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly the one that's being shifted. It's not your choice. And you're sort of the, and so I think that we're probably constantly learning about kind of where we stand based on kind of how we define ourselves, given the relationships with the people we love the most. And when you start to see people that you raised, that you, you know, in some cases gave birth to and you raised, that you witness something that sometimes you realize, oh, wow, I don't know where the hell they got that or how they know that, but certainly not from me. And other times you think, oh, my God, they actually did absorb that thing that I did not think they were aware of. And it's just fascinating. Yeah.
You talk about your mother. What about the men in your family? Did they cook? Does your father? He came right up to the past. You remember when you brought your father to the River Cafe?
Yeah.
And he was so interested in the food. He was with me. I don't know if he was interested in cooking or eating, but with me, he
loves food. He would cook something sometimes. It was sort of usually fairly simple stuff. He was a soft-boiled egg. Not soft-boiled. So, what's it called? Like when it's like
soft-boiled.
Yeah, soft-boiled.
Yeah.
Which I never in my life will understand, but he loved them. And he had that little, like, egg cup.
Yeah, and then...
And he would tap the thing.
Yeah,
and then,
that's very British. Did you live in England ever? Because that's how the English do. They call them soldiers. And you kind of do little things
and you
of
dip
bread.
The,
and then you dip
the little bread
into a very
piece,
runny
yes.
egg.
No, thank you. So I have no interest. But my dad, I think if you said to him, you could have this giant pile of gold or some eggs... He loves eggs in a way I don't think is healthy.
Yeah.
And not like unhealthy cholesterol, like I think mentally is insane.
No. So he has them all day or just for breakfast?
He'll just, if you ever want him to say yes to you, say, do you want some eggs? Because that's the, he'll never say no to that.
I'd love to see him. The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
I was obsessed for some reason with omelets. I don't know what, why, where that came from, but, you know, it looks so easy, but, like, once you start getting into it...
How do you make an omelet?
It is deceptively difficult.
It
really is.
Why?
Well, because you think, come on, what, eggs and a pan? It's like, first of all, one of the key things about an omelet, I think, is just not keeping it on the fire, because I would just sort of keep the pan there and keep the eggs there, and you have to actually take them off, as soon as they start to congeal. And then I don't like flipping it before you fill it, and then, you know, I think you want to sort of do it. But
start from the beginning. Do you put water in them, or do you put milk? Nothing.
I'll put in milk sometimes, but I'll usually just do eggs and then some salt.
What do you put in the omelet?
I have very stupid, simple, like I like a little bit of like sauteed onions in it and maybe some tomato diced up.
Nice.
But not filling things. Like I don't like bell peppers and Western omelets or any of that stuff.
Yeah, that's what I don't like about brunch in New York because they always give you these huge omelets, don't they?
Oh,
like spinach and everything, big stuff.
I'm fascinated watching, because the truth is like until there was cooking shows and things. And have you seen the Julia Child thing?
Not yet. Is it good?
She cooks an omelet in the very first episode in a way, on live TV. And it's very charming. And before there are all the cooking shows, when you go to any kind of, whether you're at a hotel or a, you know, like a buffet, when they would have someone cooking the, you know, I'm always fascinated watching someone.
Yeah, they do that little
thing. Who makes, anyone who makes like 10,000 omelets a day or whatever it is, like it's fascinating to watch someone. And then the way they flip the thing over, and you just think, or at least I think, I'm never going to be able to do. Do you flip things like that in pans?
No, I don't flip. I'm not very good at flipping, but they are. The chefs, they flip pastas, you know.
I know.
They make the penne, and then they go like that. I'm kind of standing there.
I know. It's a little bit like watching like an Olympic jumper. It scares the hell out of me. How do they do that?
I know. They kind of, I don't even know if it's necessary. I think it does coat all the pasta. It is probably. I like shaking a pan. I'm quite good at kind of like shaking. I like getting potatoes out of the oven and burning my hand, you know, shaking. I always say to the chefs, shake a pan in the oven.
Have you ever reached into the oven without putting a mitt on? Have you ever reached into the oven for something without putting a mitt on? Like, because you've just been so busy?
In the beginning, because, you know, I was never trained. So Rose and I just opened the River Cafe and said,
you were never trained
this.
To do this.
No, I took some.
Don't tell anyone this.
Yeah, why?
Because it ruins,
school will go away. So I went to cooking school when I was 14. No, we just, you know, we were family cooks, both of us. She went to live in Italy and my mother-in-law was Italian and taught me to cook, but we started so small. The River Cafe was, you know, nothing. It was teeny tiny. And so I would say we learned, well, you made small movies, didn't you? How did you, did you train to be a film director? Did you go to school?
I didn't, but I just want to, the first movie I directed was Mission Impossible 3
because
Tom Cruise asked me if I wanted to do it. And you know,
why did he
my
ask
response
you?
Was yes.
He just, yeah, did he just, he just knew. Smart guy.
He knew, look, all I know is that he and I got to know each other a little bit, and he had watched some of this TV series I'd done called Alias. It was about a spy.
So he'd seen Alias first.
And he asked if I would be interested in doing Mission Impossible 3. Yeah. So that was crazy. I started as a writer, and then I got into doing TV, and then ended up doing Mission first. But wait a minute, you were saying...
Back to the omelet. So I was just saying that I don't shake a pan, and I didn't burn...
You do shake a pan. Oh, you're reaching into the...
No, Richard used to get very upset because he used to come back with burns. You know, that was the thing. I hate...
That always scares the hell out of me.
What does it say? Would you rather have a cut or a burn? What's worse? You know, I hate burns.
Burns.
I really hate burns. Cuts, you can kind of...
No, burns are
just... Put a thing on, but a burn is upsetting.
But that's always what I think when I see people in kitchens working as you know you do. I'm always... The thing that I'm always... And it's a bit... Also talking about my mom, it's a bit like, here's one more thing I'm going to say about my mom.
Okay, go on.
She was always so careful about everything, and wanted us to be so careful. Yeah. And to see where that came from, her father, who was Harry Kelvin, who was one of my favorite people, and he was an incredible influence on me.
But why?
Because he had this electronics company called Kelvin Electronics, which is still around. Mm. And Kelvin Electronics was a place that he started after the Second War, and he sold surplus electronics as kits to schools. And
for lessons in how things work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here was a guy who was aware of how certain things, radios and TVs and telephones and things worked. So as a young kid, he would take things apart and show me how a phone worked or how a TV worked or why this happened. And then we would do these little projects together where we'd have a little plank of wood, and we would put a motor on it, and we would put little brackets to, you know, screw it in place, and then a little battery, and then a switch, and he would show me how the circuit works, and he was always demystifying things and how they work. So that was always something. But he was also, apparently, like, petrified of his grandchildren ever getting hurt.
Danger. Danger.
But you saw how he lived. Like, he was a bit paranoid. And he would have... Every corner in his house, whether it was a table, a counter, anything, he would take tissue and roll it up and then put like electrical tape on it, and everything was padded. So it was a little bit like the ridiculous, like you'd run through the house and everything was padded. So that was kind of where my mom, by the way, one thing about my grandfather, which was vaguely funny. So his company Kelvin Electronics. He had some really cool designs for some of his catalogs. And one of them was this circuit that looked like a K. And I always sort of loved it. And I loved my grandfather. Now, he was a great grandfather, but I know as a father, he was a bit tough.
To your mother.
And my mother's sister. And I think that, like, my mom would say, I think that he was bipolar. Mm. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Mm. But to me, he was just a great grandfather. Mm. And I didn't get any of that. There was a little bit of the, you know, anger here and there, but like, mm. I never had the issues that she had. Anyway, so the K design was really cool. And we were doing a little in-house visual effects company that we were calling Kelvin Optical. So I had this graphic designer who was working on a logo. And I said, oh, why don't we just use the logo that he used to use, which is the K. So she looked at it and she did some research and she came back and she said to me, oh, this is an actual circuit that exists. I'm like, oh, really?
In the shape of a K.
And she's like, it's called a bipolar circuit. Now, my mom had passed away at that point, so I couldn't call her to say, you're not going to f***ing believe this, but his logo was bipolar. But my mother was always, like, you know, nervous about things and how things happen. And for whatever reason, when I look at a kitchen and see how crazy it is, I feel like it's sort of that kind of, like, nervousness that she used to have. Mm. And I think, dear God, please put an oven mitt on, because the idea of reaching into and grabbing a mozzarella marinara pan barehanded is a nightmare.
I think that fear, people sometimes say, can we come and cook in the kitchen, or can I spend the day with you in the kitchen? And sometimes you say, but you know, it is a dangerous place. So that's my
thing.
You know, if you come in a kitchen, you know, and the chefs, the way they move and they carry hot pans, and they're always saying, and in the River Cafe, you know, we have an open kitchen, so you can't shout, you know, hot behind you move or whatever. Everybody's kind of navigating between hot plates. And if you are a chef and you leave something hot and you burn one of your colleagues, it's very upsetting. And so the kitchen is, you know, but
I hate that.
Probably kitchen's a dangerous place, and a film set's a dangerous place, isn't it?
A film set can be really dangerous and in ways that you cannot predict sometimes. I mean, I have friends who have been injured by falling lights or planks of wood or things that, you know, and there are all sorts of protections that, you know, sort of procedures that are in place, but
A kitchen.
Yeah, but when you have that many people, moving parts, that many people, that in the lights are incredibly hot, and the there are cables everywhere, and a lot of times, like in the case of the accident that we had, there was, you know, this hydraulic door that was being triggered by someone, and it just went down at the wrong moment in the wrong way, and it luckily didn't kill anyone, but certainly could have. Yeah.
But talking about restaurant kitchens, what about restaurants? Did your parents take you to restaurants? Was that a kind of Abrams that you'd celebrate in a restaurant?
Sure, but, you know, growing up, again, in L.A., like, going to the Sizzler was a big deal.
What's that?
The Sizzler. Oh, my God, steak, seafood, and salad? It's a chain here. It's a chain
I'm
of
American.
Restaurants.
I'm American. I should know that.
You should.
I didn't know what pot of noodles
I'm embarrassed
was. Pete Davidson talked about that this favorite.
About what?
Know, Pete Davidson.
Yeah.
But he's saying that his favorite meal was
a cup of noodles?
Rare, was it cup of noodles?
Yeah,
I
know. No, I
so I've been away too long. But what? So what was
no,
Sizzler?
No, we,
tell me about Sizzler.
Sizzler was, I mean, look, there were a handful of very 70s and early 80s restaurants that were at least on the West Coast or in California. One of them was Hamburger Hamlet.
Yeah, I know that one.
So I would go there.
That was good, wasn't it?
It was good. There was a place in Westwood called The Chatham that was like a little sort of fancy, I don't know, my mom would take me there. Like there were certain places we would go. At the time, growing up, Westwood, which is where UCLA is, was a great area. Mm-hmm. And it was fun, and there were just tons of restaurants and great stores. It was an amazing kind of destination, which has now changed dramatically and is sadly not what it used to be, and, you know, hopefully can recapture some of its former glory. But there were just a ton of places there. So
you'd eat out quite often?
Very often, but enough that, like, I have a lot of memories of going to these places and what I would order.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
I haven't been to very many commencement addresses, but I did listen to your address at Sarah Lawrence. And it's something I often quote, because you were talking to these kids who were about to go out into the world, and you were kind of there giving them guidance and advice at a commencement speech. But what moved me enormously was when you talked about kindness and the value of kindness. And you asked the question, have you ever been in a restaurant where food was served to you and you were with somebody who didn't look up at the waiter and say thank you? And I thought that is something that I say all the time, because I work with waiters. And they, again, so value and so moving to them when somebody says thank you. Again, why did you say that in a commencement speech?
Well, I don't remember anything I said in that speech, but I'm so glad you said it, because I was like, what are you quoting? What did I say? Oh, my God.
You should listen to it. It's a beautiful speech.
You're very sweet. But I would just say part of it is the peeve of it, but it's deeper than that, because anyone who's worked in any kind of service industry,
Did you work in a restaurant?
I did. I was a host at this Mexican restaurant here in LA. But I worked at, like, an ice cream store and, at different stores growing up. And that feeling that you have of doing well by someone and doing your job and being helpful and getting not even an acknowledgement or a look or a nod. And look, I'm sure that this happens all the time to everyone. But it's a different thing when you have the job and you know what it's like to be dehumanized and disregarded, and yet that experience for me, and part of it is because I remember as a young kid not being athletic. The value you have socially as a kid is often connected to sort of how well you play sports or how well what your grades are. If you're, my grades were never particularly great and I was never any good at sports. So weirdly, I had nothing of value as a kid. And I remember that feeling of I'm not seen as anything of either note or importance or, anything special. It was just, I remember that feeling. And so in a way, one of the reasons why, in terms of stories, like, I tend to love underdogs. And no one is crying for the little white boy who, felt like he couldn't throw a ball. But it's like the fact that you grow up in some ways, we all have insecurities and experiences that shape us. And I remember feeling like, growing up and then in these jobs, it's so easy to be unseen or overlooked or treated badly. I mean, I think people sometimes go out in order to berate people and treat people badly because it makes them feel better. Yeah. And use people as punching bags. And a waiter is like the prime example of someone who is doing you, this sort of beautiful service of, and even if the waiter's not particularly great, they're still serving you. Yeah. They're a server. Like, on that level, to not acknowledge that person and have gratitude for them says so much more about who that person is. Yeah. So I don't know quite what the context of that comment was, but my guess is don't continue the relationship with the person who treats someone
that
way.
That's what you said. And the waiters that we have, you see a lot in a restaurant. You see people crying. You see people coming to a restaurant for very private things in a public space. They get fired. They admit affairs. They get divorced. They get married. They get proposed to.
It's a window into
everything.
And do you do that?
Do you take people to a restaurant sometimes? Would you, before hiring somebody, take them to a restaurant and to kind of see
before
how they are?
I have. I mean, I've had all sorts of meetings like that with people before working on something or committing to something, sure. But I also go to restaurants to work all the time. Like,
do you? Yeah.
I write most of what I write at restaurants because the energy of the space, the noise of it, what you were just describing, it's like, when you're at a restaurant, it's like it modulates between the most extreme dramatic breakup that might be happening at the table, you know, two tables over, to that first date between people, to, you know, a parent and a child. Like, there's everywhere you look, there is a window into a drama that is probably its own story. So the inspiration that comes from just sitting in a restaurant, and a coffee shop too, but restaurants are my preference. I just feel like it kind of fuels me in a way that when I'm in a room alone, I can do that too, and I don't mind it, and I'll put headphones on, listen to some music that I like. But there's something about being in a restaurant that is hugely inspiring and I don't know, it helps me.
Do you do it now? You still go
all the time.
To rest? Really?
All the time.
Wow. Do you write longhand on a laptop? What do you do? You
take longhand when I first start working on something until it starts to become something that is starting to like become more congealed and solid and like an omelet. And then I will go and start to do it on the laptop.
Yeah. So talking, this is we're going to finish now, but comfort. So if we have food like your mother to express love or your father to grandfather about fear or we're hungry, you know, or we're in the pandemic and we want to cook, we also go to food for comfort. So if you need comfort, J.J. Abrams, is there a food that you would go to for comfort?
Is there a food?
An omelet?
There isn't really, like, I mean, it's funny. I just took my dad to dinner at Dantana's the other night in West Hollywood. And we were talking about how it was such comfort food. And usually comfort food feels like it's got a bit of an Italian, like there's something about a pasta that is just so comforting and feels so good. And, you know, so there's that kind of a thing. And it's usually like, I guess it might be like the carby, starchy thing that does it. But it's funny because as you were asking, I was like thinking, it's hard to imagine like a food that on some level doesn't provide some kind of like, you know, a really great sushi dinner or a wonderful, you know, like a great pizza or something that, you know, of course there's bad versions of everything, but food in general is just, is such a comfort.
You like that ice cream. I know. Almond ice cream, you know, the toasted almond ice cream.
Is that a question? Yeah. What do you, I mean, does my ordering multiple dishes of it indicate?
It may, that you might be partial
might like
to it.
It?
All right, can we find
I'm
it?
I'm doing it. I'm claiming it.
All right. Oh, hi. Can you do me a really quick favor?
You're looking for the recipe itself?
See if there's a recipe there for almond ice cream. You're so kind. Do you want to, I'll hold on if you find, I'm going to hold on while you find it.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.